You're listening to the Ones Ready podcast, a team of Air Force special operators forged in combat with over 70 years of combined operational experience, as well as a decade of selection instructor experience. If you're tired of settling and you want to do something you truly believe in, you're in the right place. Now here's your host, PJ team leader, jujitsu lover, meme enthusiast, and dad joke aficionado, Aaron Love.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Ones Ready podcast. This is Aaron. You're in the team room with myself and a special guest. Listen, we hear you. How many times are you going to write it on the Instagram? How many times are you going to put it to the Facebook page? Get a stow on. Fine. So this week, we got a stow on. Before we start, I want to say thanks to all of our friends out there in the industry that have been by our side since we started. Alpha Brew Coffee, Strike Force Energy, and Everly Stock. Go over to their respective websites and organizations. Use the code ONESREADY and you'll get a sweet discount. We don't see any of that sweet cash, but they know that we sent you. And then we can all partner forward and go forward. Because, as always, a rising tide raises all boats. Much ado about nothing. That's completely over. Stow. Lieutenant Matthew Winkelier, Wink, what's up? Thanks for coming on. How are you?
Hey, Aaron. Thanks for having me.
I like how we're having this conversation. We live literally a block away. I was like, hey, what do you want me to call you before the podcast? Wink and I were talking. I was like, you want me to just call you Wink? He's like, yeah, it's not like I'm hidden. There's one Winkelier on the global. I think they're going to know it's me. So how's this Friday morning treating you, dude?
Nah, it's pretty good so far. It's sunny and cold up here in Washington. It's not raining, so.
I know, yeah. Fantastic. So if you guys don't know, Wink was a prior enlisted CCT. So that means he started off as you know, your combat controller. Just take us all the way back, Wink. Tell us a little bit about, you know, how you got into the Air Force. You know, was getting into the Air Force and being a controller something you thought you wanted to do all the time? Or did you just come up with it in high school?
Yeah, sure. So I enlisted in the Air Force back in 2008. Prior to that, I'm originally from Long Island, New York. I attended college in upstate New York and then at a school on Long Island. It wasn't something I was originally planning on doing, but both my parents were prior Air Force, so I knew quite a bit about it. The effects of 9/11 back in 2001 hit our community pretty hard, and you know, a lot of my friends and myself were, you know, feeling a little more patriotic than we used to after that all happened, and we saw the communities come together. So I graduated high school in 2003.
I imagine being in Long Island had something to do with it too, like just being in that, anywhere in that area. I was in Ohio, and I mean, I felt, you know, at least some geographical connection because of the Shanksville plane, Flight 93. But yeah, I imagine we were on Long Island. There was a pretty big push at that point.
Yeah. So I was a sophomore in high school when that all happened, and we actually had some families from my high school that lost like parents and relatives and stuff through that. So it definitely kind of rocked through all the communities over there. So yeah, I graduated high school in 2003, attended college immediately after for soccer and track. My major at the time was linguistics. So it's not something that...
What is you going to go work for the big linguistics company down? Do they not have anybody that speaks those languages or what?
Yeah, my whole plan was to go like English as a second language teacher and do a whole bunch of traveling.
I'm not mad at that then.
Yeah. So still get to travel now, just not in that same capacity. But so yeah, after like 3.5 years of college or so, I decided to enlist. I felt like I was ready to. At the time, I was doing like surfing, triathlon, soccer, a lot of endurance type things. So the that aspect of combat controls and pararescue and stuff really spoke to me. I actually live near the pararescue guard base in West Hampton, and I was just like at the local Y with one of the pararescue guys that came in and, you know, kind of told me a little bit about combat control and pararescue. And he said basically, hey, like, you can go pararescue and save people, you can go combat control and you know, fight and kill people through like air power. And my dad is a prior air traffic controller with the FAA and in the Air Force prior to that. So I knew a whole lot about air traffic control. So I lean more towards that way.
Right.
So enlisted in 2008, and then I did 9 years as an enlisted combat controller. At that point, I finished up my college degree while I was enlisted, and I decided that I wanted to go and try and lead people. So I crossed over.
Oh, that's hurtful. You know, I'm going to call you. Let's pause right there. So, you know, you talk about your enlisted time. Like, what was your enlisted time like as a combat controller? People always wonder, especially coming straight in off the streets. And that was immediately, you know, post 9/11. So I imagine, you know, the pipeline was probably, you know, pretty hectic. It was probably a different flavor. I was going through, you know, the same pipe or the same sort of feeling, you know, pipeline stuff right about the same time as you were. So, you know, what was it like for you back then?
So the pipeline was a pretty big shock when I first came into it. I don't think at that point you definitely didn't have the resources that you have now. Like,
no, absolutely not. No
podcast or anything else. Like yeah. I had to, when I was trying to get recruited for combat control, they didn't have special operations recruiters or anything. So I basically went to my Air Force recruiter and I told him how to give me a pass test and how to mark it down and stuff. So I had to tell him all
about solid. Good job.
Say, hey man, like this is what you need to do. Like this is what it is. And that's how it got submitted up. So you had to do a whole bunch of research on your own because really you didn't have the resources that you have now. Once I entered the pipeline, it's kind of the same thing. You didn't really know what you were getting yourself into. And you, within the first couple days, guys, once they were going through the orientation course, were either, you know, pissed off and quit because they're like, this is not what I thought it was going to be. Or you right. got guys that got super motivated and just were too dumb or too tough to quit because they wanted to, you know, prove something to themselves or instructors or whatever. But there's a lot yeah. of different motivations. But if you didn't have a good one going in, it was very easy to find reasons to quit, whether it's in those pool sessions or the really long ground training iterations where you're just doing calisthenics and that type of stuff nonstop.
Grass and gorillas in Texas forever. On the last podcast, we were joking around about, you know, having those guys that kind of show up at selection, don't really know what's going on. And they, exactly like you said, they take like one of two ways. They either figure out what the job is all about and they're like, holy cow, let's go do this thing. Or they're like, man, I am out of here. And they kind of quit and bounce out. So, you know, moving forward throughout, did you deploy as a controller?
Yeah, I deployed multiple times as a controller to many different continents. I was previously stationed in Okinawa, Japan, as nice. Well as in Florida. So I got the Pacific, got the Central in Asia and all that. So it's been no deployment for me has been the same, which is something I really like about it. It's definitely not a career field that you go in and do the same thing every day. And that applies true to your deployments as well. Right. Whether it be moving up through the ranks enlisted or officer, or just in general where you're stationed.
Got it. So then you hit 7 years, you got some deployments under your belt, you've accomplished a whole lot at that point, right? So, and then you decide to take on another challenge and you want to be an officer and you want to go be a STO. So what was actually the trigger point? I know I was making fun of you for saying, you know, you wanted to lead people yeah. and I was going to say, hey, enlisted leadership, hey, whatever. But, you know, what was the transition point for you to go and say, all right, cool, I think I've accomplished everything I can as an enlisted dude. Let me try out being this officer.
So for me, when I transitioned over, I was an E6. And at that point, I was at my 8-year mark and I had a decision to make if I wanted to make this a career, like a 20-year career, if I wanted to get out, because I actually had a job lined up at the FAA as an air traffic controller and they were going to hold it for a certain amount of time for me. And it was coming to that point. So my wife still lets me know that, you know, I could be living in Denver, Colorado, being an ATC guy, and not traveling as much.
Every once in a while, she just throws that, just hits you with that knife. Just, hey, we could be in Colorado right now. You could be an air traffic controller. None of this would be going on.
That's exactly right. yeah. So at that point, it was coming up to my 10-year mark, and I felt like that was a decision point for me if I want to stay in and make it a career or if I want to get out. At that point, I decided to finish up my degree. And you're absolutely right about the enlisted leadership and the officer thing. Like, there's no wrong answer when it comes to that. But I felt like switching over into officer, I could help a lot more of the up and out and protecting the enlisted guys on the teams that I was going to be on. What works and what doesn't in terms of leadership from a troop level and protecting those guys while still accomplishing the things that the commanders need you to accomplish. So I felt I could strike that right balance. And I wanted selfishly at that point, go from an E6 to E7, your team time is a little bit more limited.
You're working on borrowed time right there. Like, you don't know when that next WEPTAC assignment is coming or, you know, yeah.
Yeah. So, and straight up the career field manager for combat control basically gave me a shout out that after, you know, in the near future, he was planning on putting me in an overseas unit and like a training and evaluation standpoint, because I needed like senior, mid to senior level E6s to go and do that. So I felt by going the officer route, it would allow me to get that team time more, have that top cover for the guys that I knew and I knew wanted to train and work. And I felt like I could do that effectively on both capacities. Ironically, once I turned, switched over to become an officer, my first assignment was in future operations, like literally the same job I would have had as an E6.
Got him.
Didn't work out as planned, but right. But it's working out a little better now.
Yeah. Can you talk about the selection process? And we've put it out there for the phase one and phase two process, but straight from the horse's mouth as a guy that's recently gone through it, just tell us what it's like for a STOW or for an officer really to cross train specifically into STOW and go to phase one and phase two selection. So if you can, it doesn't have to be crazy, but just hit the wave tops for us. What does that process look like?
Sure. So, like everything else, you have your phase one application you're going to be submitting through and hoping to get picked up for that phase two. A majority for me, since I was a prior, like a majority of the career field.
Let me pause you there. So the phase one application, that's all your paperwork that you're putting, like, what did you have to put in that packet? Cause people always ask us, you know, there's a narrative in there. How do I make myself sound, in the top 10% of these packets?
So that's a pretty good question. And my answer to that is going to be, you need to know why you're doing it. There's a bunch of these packets I go through all the time. And a lot of the guys that are involved in the selection process, you'll have a mix of guys that have been doing recruiting for a while, or some that are just new to it and just reviewing your packet. And it might be, you know, guys at a line unit or something that are looking there. So the biggest thing with that is if you are, can I curse?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Sorry, dude. I know. You're fine,
it's on you.
If you're not genuine in your responses and your narrative and why you want to do this, you can see through that. Whether if you go into phase two and those guys have files on you while they're reviewing you in the phase two sense, they'll know right away if your phase one packet was full of shit, for lack of a better term.
Got it. So,
a way to put yourself in that top 10% is one, be genuine, two, do a lot of research and know why you're going into a STOW or a CROW or those type of career fields. And I think that kind of rings true across the Air Force. So you're going to be an officer, right? You're going to be a leader first. If you are trying to go into a STOW career field and you're putting in your phase one packet and you're like, I want to be a STOW because I just want to go and job it and fight on the front lines and stuff, that's probably not the right spot. You should probably go enlisted first, because that's the primary duty, right? As a Air Force officer, you're there to lead and manage people first, and that especially rings true throughout your time as a STOW. If you get there, it's a selfless leader position, and the minute you start like trying to look to do things for yourself, you're going to take it away from those other enlisted guys. And that's something the enlisted guys see, and it affects your credibility and their respect with you. And also, from a leadership perspective, the leaders above you can see that too. So it's a pretty big deal. So, understand that it's that selfless leader position. Make your phase one package read that way, and that you are there to better the career field as a whole, and not just like yourself for the glory, or if you will, you know.
Yeah. Well, and then, you know, where the rubber meets the road is that phase two selection. So that, you know, seven to 10 day process that they're running out of Herbie. How did that compare, the phase two portion, to your orientation course or NDOC, or, you know, previous time as a combat controller?
So
just a little laugh. How much time you got, buddy?
Yeah. No, so the biggest thing was I came in through as a combat controller at 22 years old. I assessed for phase two as a STOW with like multiple deployments and a 31-year-old STOW with two surgeries under his belt.
Right, so yeah.
For me, the biggest thing was understanding that a ROTC cadet or an academy cadet that was 21, 20 years old, training for this nonstop, as opposed to me, an E6 tech sergeant just getting off of surgery, probably going into another one, and at the end of the day, when that phase two assessment ended, I still had to go back to work to go TDYs to go and continue being a combat controller.
You had to go back to being a combat controller, yeah, right.
Right. So for me, you want to crush every event that you come into there. I'm sure you've addressed the phase two and what that's like. But understanding that it's a marathon and not just, you know, balls to the wall in every event for an injury perspective, you're not going to do anyone any good if you're getting injured. And I'm not saying to slack on any event. That's not what I'm trying to imply there. I'm just saying.
I think you just said to scurve on a couple of events, like, hey, save your energy. This is going to be a long day. That's what I heard. So
take it as you will.
You know, that's awesome.
You're going through at 32 or 33, knowing that you don't need to absolutely sprint the first event on a Monday morning at 5:30 a.m. when you're going to end later on in the week. I mean, it might be something to consider. You know,
that's like, wisdom. Applied knowledge. That's wisdom. That's what that is. Did you find, so especially in the interview process and some of the psychological evaluations in the phase two selection process, did you find yourself making it a point to try to transition between that tech sergeant, NCO sort of team leader role over to the officer role? Like how did that work for you? Did they trip you up with any of those questions when you were at phase two?
Those questions were asked, but those questions were asked prior in phase two and then prior to that as well. And that was one of the main things that I thought would have been my, not limitation, but more struggle would be transition over from a, you know, very career field savvy E6 to a leader of those. And not really the biggest struggle I continue to have is trying not to micromanage those NCOs that are really well skilled in knowledge and let them run and do the job correctly and not try and take on all those tasks. So those were a lot of questions that were asked of me for my specific situation, and they weren't trip ups at all. Like it was kind of something I knew was coming because it's just the unique situation that I was in. And I think anyone that's crossing over into whatever career field, whether it be a prior enlisted going in or a prior officer trying to cross into phase two, you're going to get some similar questions asked. I would imagine.
Really
my answer to that was, again, pretty genuine, like, yeah, I know this is going to be one of my struggles and it's something I'm going to be focusing on throughout my time there. So you try and strike that fine balance of leadership and delegation, and then actually going and, you know, putting your head down and getting the task done that needs to be. One of the biggest things that was brought to light for me during phase two is when I was put in those leadership positions, if I had, like, my head down to doing one individual task too focused, I couldn't take a step back and see the big picture, which is what you need to do a lot of times as a STO on multiple different mission sets and mission sets, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny how that stuff will transfer straight over. It's fun, you know, the lessons that you learn, like, hey, I can't get sucked into this problem. I need to be able to step back, look at this entire problem, and then fix it. It's funny that you, the first time that you were like, hey, that's a transitional piece for me. This is who I am now. I can't be the guy that's on the X. I got to step back. That's actually pretty cool that you can learn stuff from those selections and carry them forward. So,
and I think, like, one of the biggest, you know, one of my biggest stories that I remember from selection, without, you know, getting too into the weeds of everything entails, is we were doing a team physical event over a long period of time, and I was put into a leadership position, and you know, striking that balance right away was something that I had to focus on, because you either carry a whole bunch of weight and focus on, you know, the one task that needs to be accomplished while the whole team is trying to get that task done, but the minute you do that, like the instructors or anyone else will inject to make sure that you know that you need to take that step back and have that that head up and out and see the whole big picture and not just carry as much weight as you can, you know. And that's the biggest thing that I've tried to take away from that, is to continue to understand that, yeah, like I can do this one task really well. I can take it off like one or maybe two guys' hands, but the 8 or 9 other guys that are relying on me to, you know, guide them the right direction, see that big picture, is something that I need to focus on more. And the guys that on my team will understand that that's my focus at that point. And that's really transitioning over to team level. It's where that up and out comes into play, and having that credibility and really transparency and communication, understanding from my level down to them and from their level to me, that's like, those are our specified tasks.
Yeah. And that's a great transition. One of the questions that people ask us all the time about STOs is, number one, like, what is a STO? Like, tell us in your own words, man, what's a STO? What's a special tactics officer?
So for me, a special tactics officer, all comes down to, you're in the Air Force, you're leading and managing people. Those people that you're leading and managing are those that have put an absurd amount of time into their job. They've given a lot of sacrifices up to get there, and they want to be led correctly. So it's up to me to do that. Now, we have a lot more dynamic challenges because we may have a whole bunch of different mission sets that we're dealing with, whether it be that strike, that access, that personnel recovery that we're focused on. And we do have a couple of different career fields that we're working with as well. But for me, it's leading and managing those guys that have a great amount of talent and that want to be there. It's very easy to lead people by force, but it's much harder to do it because they want to. And that's something that I have to focus on a whole bunch. So with that, like your training phases and stuff, yeah, you're setting up those training plans. You are taking those the intents from your higher up, and you are making sure that the team that you're on is accurately pursuing and achieving those goals that leads up to your ultimate deployment. So you could be running an 8 to 15 man team on a battlefield for some kind of mission situation with recovery or access, or you could be managing a whole bunch of guys that are focused on that JTAC and strike portion that are going to farm out to those different teams when you deploy, or you could be sitting in a liaison position having to kind of answer all those questions to a bunch of other Air Force personnel that don't know much about special warfare. So those deployment pictures can look pretty dynamic. So I can't give you like, hey, this is what you're going to do as a stow on your deployment. Like, it's so wide ranging.
Yeah. And we deal with that a lot. We're like, holy cow, guys will be like, well, you know, does X career field do Y? And we're like, holy cow, man, that's a roll of the dice. There's a ton of luck involved. You know, whether, you know, you think being busy is lucky or being not busy is lucky, depending on how you're kind of looking at it. But deployments are a weird beast. What you see and what you do. And it's really a testament to the Stowe career field, how diverse you guys really are, because you just ripped off like 10 or, you know, so many different capabilities that you had right there that put you in the position to do all those different things on deployment. I always thought, you know, special tactics officer and then combat rescue officer, I always thought those were such diverse officer career fields, because you can really do a ton of different stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's special warfare in general has such a unique mission set, even outside of Stowe Crow. Look at like a combat controller or PJ, you know, like SR, right now.
Yeah.
Or an SR. Yeah. Just, you can think about how many people we have all over the world right now, and each one of them, their job is not the same as the guy, you know, in one country over, you know, obviously a continent over. So, but yeah, like that's been kind of the recurrent theme throughout my whole career and most guys' careers is you might have some deployments that look the same in terms of what you're doing job wise, but probably not.
Well, and you even have, you know, some really distinct stuff in your history, just because I love that we're having this conversation and I'm pretending like I'm interviewing you. But once again, like we did all of these things yesterday. Like we saw each other yesterday and made our training plan, and like we work together every day. So it's funny, but, I'll just continue to pretend as if I'm interviewing you, and I don't know, but because I do know your backstory, you've actually been involved in some really distinct stuff, like going for humanitarian operations or helping open airfields that were previously closed to assuage a national disaster, and all those other things. Like even you as a Stowe have some of the kind of the one-off missions of a lifetime. And what was it like being involved on something that you, even as a Stowe, you're like, holy cow, I could have never thought up that scenario.
It comes down to training and preparation and being adaptable to whatever may be thrown at you. So a couple of my deployments, one of them in particular was it wasn't supposed to be, but I ended up doing work in the Philippines, and in 2013 when Typhoon Haiyan hit over there, and it just destroyed a whole bunch of Eastern Philippines. And that was not my role at the time. I was like the one combat controller in the area that was working with the partner forces. But I basically got phone calls. I'm saying, hey, like, you're a combat controller, can you open up airfields? And, you know, yeah, I can. But we actually had some old, like 1990s series, like runway lights and stuff that I end up having to, literally
it's just guys with flashlights.
Oh man, it was crazy. So
hey, go stand over there in a square. You guys go stand over there.
Man, I was in Manila at the time because we were in a lockdown just because the typhoon was passing. Mm-hmm. And we basically got a phone call like, hey, like, can you go over an airfield like out the east if we can get you out there? And it's, well, yeah, I need lights, so I need to fly down south. So I ended up like, they ended up flying me down south to pull up like a bunch of AZL lights, which are like the old school airfield lights. They're just like the push button on and off, just little white ones.
Okay.
And they were not in the best working order. Like the batteries expired in like 2008 and this was in 2013. So
those will be fine.
Yeah. The whole flight out to landing zone, we were in a small aircraft cause we knew that the airfield could handle it. I'm literally like opening up boxes of little lights and testing batteries to see which ones work and what don't. So I can give an accurate, lifespan for how long we can keep the runway open at night to start bringing in others. And at my team that I asked for just any kind of support whatsoever for airfield security or anything else. And my team was like a couple of conventional army guys that were like a combo guy. And then the embassy liaison that was like an Air Force major came out there to start like interfacing to get stuff in. So then we hit the ground and there was already like 4,000 or 5,000 displaced personnel that were lined up trying to get out. The air traffic control tower, the radios were intermittent, but they had the Philippine air traffic controllers up there. So I gave them some of my radios to use for primary ATC. And then whenever an American aircraft started coming in, I was that liaison to them just to give them a heads up. Because as a Air Force combat control, you know a little bit more what the military aircraft are going to be looking for like these type of situations than like a Filipino, conventional civilian air traffic controller. So that I ended up being like the American interface for that, as well as making sure the runway is cleared, making more helicopter space and just clearing all debris out, because we knew like a whole effort was coming. And man, there was something like 40 or 50 different countries that started bringing C-130s and other stuff in at the time. And then once the additional follow-on forces got there, the American guys from Okinawa, then I went back to Manila, where they were starting to stand up like a joint operations center with U.S. aid and a couple other civilian entities. And I just ended up being a liaison for special tactics at the time to let them know capabilities, limitations, where everybody was, and start like driving that way. And one thing I find about special tactics is we're extremely proactive and we want to go get the mission done. And we don't look at the limitations and give a can't, we give why we can. You know, so that's what I found from there was our guys, when we started getting down there, just, you know, pulled CV-22s and everything else and just started going to find helicopter landing zones to bring aid or anything else and a humanitarian effort. Time's of the essence there. So that's something that that our guys did extremely well, was look to find work, find displaced areas and start trying to get as far out there as you could to rescue as many people as you could.
Even if you need to commandeer, maybe, I don't know, a forklift, even if you have to like get some cars off the runway, who knows?
Yeah. I think the guys in Japan during the Fukushima power plant disaster absolutely did that. You might know a few of those guys.
I might've known some people that hotwired a car one time, but I can't I can't confirm nor deny that story. So,
that was one. And then the most recent one was in 16 in the Caribbean. When Hurricane Irma, Maria, and that whole series hit through, we ended up going down to the British Virgin Islands. At that time, I was tasked as the NCOIC, and I had an O3 Crow that went down with me. We staged out of Puerto Rico, and I had an 8-man team, and we were going to like British Virgin Islands, Anguilla, St. Martin was the third one that we started doing assessments and stuff for, and interfacing with whatever military was out there. And that was, again, another like can ramble on for an hour about how SD just gets things done ridiculously efficiently.
Right. Yep. You know,
it's pretty funny. But yeah.
So, and this is going to be another funny question because we work in the same office, but the other question we get about, you know, Stowe's is, hey, what's day-to-day life like? So what do you do when you're home station, when you're a Stowe? I know this answer very well because usually you're telling me what it is that you need me to do that week. But you know, for everybody out there that's thinking about going the Stowe route, what's your day-to-day like as a Stowe?
So your day-to-day, particularly address it on a team, because when you first get out of the pipeline, you're going to go on a team to get that experience, is you're going to be managing an 18 to 24 man team consisting of combat control, Pararescue, SR, or TAC-P, depending on if you're on that access or strike or recovery package. So your troop, you're going to be leading, managing, executing that commander's intent and making sure it flows down. You guys are meeting those intents for ultimately a deployment because you're training to deploy, right? You don't want to practice all day and all year just to go next year and just practice again. That just frustrates everybody. So you're preparing for that deployment. So it's a lot of paperwork. And you have to know a lot about the enlisted force structured regs, as well as those intents of the commanders passing down. Because not only are you trying to develop those guys for that training for deployment, you're trying to develop future leaders into, right? So you have like your E7s and E6s that will be executing that down and in type stuff while you're working with the commander and your supervisors to make sure that up and out is met accordingly. And between you and your troop chief, you're going to make sure that everyone's speaking the same sheet of music, really. One thing that I think it's important that a lot of guys, younger stows, overlook when they first get in is understanding that you have a bunch of guys from like a brand new E4 to like an 18-year E7 that are going to be in your troop. All of them have valuable information and a majority of them are going to know more than you about their jobs. So you really have to put a lot of trust into them. And you know, if there's any questions that guys like your E7 troop chief or your E6s will let you know about that. I think guys that are prior controls like myself are in that unique position that we have a little more understanding of the jobs when we get onto a troop and we can look and see those things. But as a new stow, like you're going to be there to really work those intents, but also you're going to be a sponge because you want to learn as much as you can about the job so you can effectively make decisions and lead your guys.
Yeah. And it's even tougher for guys that come, you know, as a cross trainee or as a guy that goes officer to enlisted guy or gal that goes, you know, officer to or enlisted officer. It's really tough because, you know, sometimes you can see exactly what needs to happen in that lane over there, but that's just not your lane anymore. And I struggle with it too. There are some times where I'm like, oh, I can totally see that problem right there, but that's not my business. So that's always a tough one to kind of figure out, is that officer enlisted role on the troop.
The worst thing I see is when I watch guys struggle and I know how to fix it. And just sitting back. And actually, there's been a few times where we've been on situations where I'm like, Aaron, I just need to shut up. Like,
that's why I'm there. Because you can pull me and be like, Aaron, I need to shut up. I'm talking too much. All right, well, let's get it back here. I specifically remember that was on the cold weather trip. So,
yeah.
Hey, let's ski in the back over here. We'll just let the team go for a little bit. You just ranted and raved a little bit and then you were better.
Yeah, pretty much. I think it's like being a good NCO too. You let your guys fail within reason.
Yeah.
Let them work through problems because that's how you're going to learn the best. But again, as a stow, it is your job to make sure those guys are learning those hard lessons and really knowing how those guys learn too. Like my E4 6'3", 250-pound vegan is going to learn different than 5'8", 160-pound like SR guy. Like, it's just everyone has those different styles that's most effective for them. So it's up to you and your troop chiefs and your special tactics team leaders to really understand what each of those guys' capabilities and limitations are and affect them accordingly. So really, if you're going to be getting onto a new team, man, I'd get with those senior enlisted guys and learn as much as you can from them. And making sure, I hate to say it, but making sure all that paperwork and other stuff is done along the way. You want those guys to develop up, stay in, and stay proactive. So for day-to-day to us, really, I'm sure you've hit the stuff in terms of training. Like, your TDYs are going to be different every week, just like every other specialty that's in special warfare.
Yeah.
So from that training perspective, you're going to be doing all the same things. You're going to train for the deployments. You just have to do quite a bit more paperwork and understand those leadership methodologies. And I think the other thing that special warfare guys need to focus on too is really understanding how the big Air Force works, because a lot of your training is in that joint or that big Air Force combined capability.
Oh yeah. There is nobody that cares less if you're in special warfare than somebody that works at the range that you haven't filled the paperwork out. Like, that guy could not care less if you are you could be a CAG operator of 20 years and have actually shot Bin Laden. And he's like, I don't care. Where's your 44, 45? That's the range for him. All right, get out. Like,
I think the minute you come into any situation, whether it be with like working with aircraft, working with the logistics officer on your base for like vehicle maintenance issues, or working with like an Army range control, the minute you come in, you're like, hey man, I don't know if you know this, but I'm a stow. So this is how we're going to do things. It's the minute you just get a foot in your ass out the door, you know, and that's something
that's fantastic.
I think it's something that you really need to consider. At the end of the day, man, people are people within the military, and you have military structure. No one's going to care that you're like an 0203 just out of the pipeline, that you need to get stuff done because special warfare depends on it. I promise you, like, that one scenario is not going to work out well for you. Really,
absolutely.
It's like everything else, right? You build relationships and you get those deals done and you're building your rapport, and that's how you can really positively affect like your troop or the squadron. So making sure you get that Air Force involvement is important, both for your own development and for the development and credibility of the career field. As special warfare officers kind of open up, they combine more, like that Stow, Pro 19, Zulu, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. The opportunities for different positions are going to be pretty prevalent. And I think that's the same if you're in E7 to E9 as like a pararescue combat controller. You'll get out of the team special tactics squadron job position for a little bit, and you'll go into a big Air Force or maybe a joint or other position. So it really behooves you to know a lot more than just like, hey, special warfare is my lane, this is what I do, that's it. It's great, there's nothing wrong with that, but you might not have the choice. You might be put into those other positions because you have a good personality for it, or they just need a person there that's effective.
Yeah, and I want to hit 2 points here. So I want to talk about the AFSC change. So April 30th, they came out, and now all, you know, Stowe and Crow and officers, TACPO, under Air Force Special Warfare, those dudes and dudettes are all underneath the new AFSC, which is your 19, it's the 19 Zulu series, 19 Zulu X-ray series for officers. So that's a huge change, and we're all under the same umbrella now, and there's really no kidding, you know, progress that we're seeing going forward. What do you think are some upcoming changes that are going to happen inside of kind of like Air Force Special Warfare as a whole? Like, we went to SR away from SAUT. We've got all the officers under a single career field with different shred outs now. Like, what are the other changes that you see coming down the road for Air Force Special Warfare?
Are you asking from like an officer perspective?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, so what I see for that 19 Zulu, especially when it comes to Stows and Crows, is you're going to, I would think you might have the ability to shift over squads a little bit. What I mean by that's like, I think in the future, Stows are going to have the ability to go into rescue squadrons. And we already have Crows that are coming to special warfare squadrons and are leading teams, and that's been for some time now. So I think the core missions obviously are not going to change with that access, strike, and recovery and stuff. But I think as a Stow, it would make sense for to have Stows focus in on that recovery aspect more so for that transition. So for example, I'm on a recovery focused team right now, and I know that there's other squadrons that have those recovery mission sets as well. So I think between those two, there's going to be a lot more interchangeability in terms of positions for TACP officers, since they fall under that 19 Zulu. I would imagine you'd be seeing some more TACP officers come into those AFSOX units more than just the 17th STS, but actually coming through like something like the 2-3 or the 2-2 or something like that. So I foresee a lot more interchanging and more positions that are like, it's a 19 Zulu, not a Stow position, you know?
Got
so
it.
I think it's,
yeah.
I think it's opened up some more doors. And I also see us being put into more positions in a joint capacity. Yeah. So that would be something I would expect.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. And for everybody out there, so 19 Zulu X-ray Alpha, those are your Stows. The Bravos, so Zulu X-ray Bravos, those are your TACP officers. And then the Charlies are your Crows. So yeah, big things on the horizon, getting everybody kind of under the same umbrella, as far as, you know, the combination of career fields. It's not a combination of career fields. It's just putting everybody under the same sort of flag and moving forward to create efficiencies. If we all go together, it'll be a whole lot easier. How many, have you ever gotten to work with a TACP officer, just as a random question?
No, I have not.
Yeah, I haven't. That's why I was asking. I haven't crossed paths with them either. Like I've never actually worked, you know, with one or been near one. So man, it'll be a good thing. I'm sure they bring a lot to the fight. So, all right. So now for the big one here. So going back all the way back to your enlisted time, would you change anything about your transition from enlisted to officer? Like maybe would you have gone earlier if you could go back and, you know, perfect scenario, you could avoid going through the pipeline as a 31-year-old dude with two surgeries, going back in time, would you change that up at all?
No, I loved my enlisted time. Like I said earlier, when you go enlisted, you're going there to go and do the job, right? The job that you're assigned to do, and you'll be tasked accordingly. If you go, if you're going STOW, you might get that opportunity, but your ultimate goal is to manage the people that go and do those jobs. So, getting those JTAC deployments, getting those other, deployments that a combat controller can get, absolutely wouldn't change it. I felt like that amount of time was, you know, a crossover in 9 years. I felt like that amount of time was great. I was getting to that point that they were going to start moving me off the team. I want to stay on the team. I wanted to lead. And I really wanted to like manage those guys, and I felt like I could affect them accordingly. So now, like even coming in at 22, I thought it was you know, looking back on it now, I thought it might have been too late at the time. But I felt like if I came in straight out of high school, I wouldn't have had like the maturity or the drive to go in and complete the pipeline. And I give a lot of credit to those young dudes that are like, I'm coming straight out of high school and I'm going pararescue.
Those types that come in at 17, like holy cow.
Yeah, you graduate the pipeline, you're like, cool, I'm 19, 20, I still can't
train. I still can't.
I'm getting on a team of guys like, you know, with Aaron that are 37 and pissed off all the time. It's not worked out well for me.
So thanks for giving me the break on 2 years, but I am pissed off all the time. You're right there.
There you go. So I give all those guys a whole bunch of credit. And I don't think there's any one time that you're like, hey, 22, 23 years old, that's when you should come in. Man, everyone develops, matures different. Everyone has different reasons for coming in. So we had guys on my team that were 18 years old, and we had guys that are my team that were 30 years old. And both those guys made it through for whatever reasons they had. You know, obviously, the older you get, you might have families or other things to deal with. But yeah, man, I couldn't imagine being an 18, 19 year old guy that just gets his ass kicked all day out in the pool or anything else, goes in and like gets online and sees all his buddies on Facebook, like partying in the colleges that you could have went to. it's something to mentally prepare for. And you're like, man, like this, you got to know why you want to do it. At that point, I think is the biggest hurdle that you need to overcome. I've seen some guys come in too early and get washed out. Yeah. And then come back a couple of years later and then crush the pipeline, and they're doing great as combat controls and pararescue men. So it's, you know, there's no one right situation for everyone. For me, I thought 31, I thought was a little bit later to cross into STOW, but I didn't want to do it any sooner, because when I, at that point I was, planning up for another deployment. I knew what I was going to be doing and I wanted to go. So I assessed after like one of the deployments I got through, and I could train properly for it. So, no, I really wouldn't change anything. Long story short,
nice.
It was pretty sweet being enlisted for that long. And I got some really good, experiences that I can kind of carry over to the guys now.
Nice. Awesome. Well, hey, I want to close it up on this one. I want you to give your, you know, give your top three pieces of advice. If there's somebody out there right now that's considering coming in as a crow or as a STOW, a special tactics officer, or as an Air Force special warfare officer as a whole, if they're considering, you know, making that leap, whether they're in college right now or if they're an enlisted guy or gal that wants to make that transition, man, give us like your big three pieces of advice for those people.
So coming into these career fields, you need to be a selfless leader. The minute you focus on yourself is the minute everyone else sees it, and you just will not be as effective. You're going to need to be transparent with your communication in every aspect, both looking up and looking down. And that's something that's very, very important in my mind, is that communication and that ability to be that transparent. You need to really know why you're doing it, because it's a 2-year pipeline. If you're going through that phase two, that's just the start of the 2-year journey. And those cadre and those recruiters, they are assessing your ability to endure a 2-year pipeline. And if the risk is worth the reward of taking you on, first of all, that you know, 80 to 90% washout rate. That is the pipeline. And then beyond that, you know, is it worth it to pick you up and why is it? So that's something you'll need to consider there. And then, my third one is make yourself as physically capable as you can. Cause when you're going through, you as going through for Stowe or Crow, probably have a little bit more knowledge, and understanding than the people that you'll be leading throughout the pipeline that are enlisted. One of the reasons is because if you go Stowe and you get picked up, like you'll be based out of Herbert Field, Florida, where you're training at the Special Tactics Training Squadron every single day while your guys are, while your enlisted counterparts will be going through boot camp or be sitting down at Lackland waiting to go to their next school. You have a lot more understanding at that point. And if you are not physically capable, it is just one more thing for you to have to worry about while your team is getting put through very dynamic, challenging scenarios. Like you don't want to focus inward on yourself while you're doing your 997th push-up and about to go and like do litter carries for the next 2 hours. You know, you want to focus out on your team to make sure everything else is good. And I think that's, you know, inherently what being a special tactics leader is all about. So don't physically limit you. Don't not be physically capable to do that and focus on your team while shit's hitting the fan, you know, so.
Got it. Got it. That's an awesome one to end on, sir. Hey, thanks for coming on, Wink. We really appreciate it. Everybody go check out the podcast on Apple Podcasts, anywhere you can find us. Hit the Instagram account. If you got questions for Wink, do you just want him to hit the Ones Ready account and we can link you up with those people if you need to?
Yeah, that's fine.
Word. Yeah. So drop us a note if you guys have further questions on Stowe or Special Tactics Officer or Air Force Special Warfare Officer, let us know. But for now, Wink, thanks for coming out. Appreciate it. Everybody else, train hard. We'll see you next time.